Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN humanitarians have described as unprecedented the continuing outflow of children and families fleeing relentless shelling from the Russian military action in Ukraine. A week since Russia's self-styled special operation began, 500,000 children have already been forced to flee their homes, said the UN Children's Fund on Friday. The psychological toll that the barrage of shelling and sirens has had on countless families fleeing the country is clear. Here's Yunga Gedini-Williams from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, speaking from Moldova's border with Ukraine.
One family that I spoke to, it was a mother with her three children in the car and their two dogs. They were all very shaken up. The youngest child, who was a young girl of, I would guess, around 8 or 9, was visibly shaken.
Deeper within Ukraine, many cities have faced relentless shelling, according to the UN Humanitarian Coordinating Office, OCHA, while UN aid teams continue to push for safe access to get critical supplies in and the most vulnerable people out. In the Human Rights Council, member states have voted to set up a top-level probe into rights violations in Ukraine as Russia's military offensive continues. Capping discussions spanning 2 days in Geneva, two-thirds of the council voted to set up a commission of inquiry on Friday. Two member states voted against and 13 abstained. Ukraine, which had called for the vote on a resolution condemning Russian aggression, said that the probe was the only way to ensure that such a blatant dereliction of human rights values will never repeat itself in any place of the world. Opposing the resolution, Russia's Evgeny Ustinov alleged that thousands of people have been killed and maimed by the authorities in eastern Ukraine. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has appealed for $205 million to deliver life-saving assistance and protection to over 1.6 million people displaced by the conflict in northern Ethiopia. 16 months of conflict in northern Ethiopia between central government and separatist forces has created a huge humanitarian crisis, said spokesperson Shabir Mantu. Civilians, including refugees and internally displaced people, have been forced to leave their homes, Ms. Mantu said, citing widespread reports of gender-based violence, human rights abuses, and critical levels of food insecurity. To date, more than 2 million Ethiopians have been displaced within the country, and almost 60,000 have fled across the border into Sudan. Several camps and settlements hosting Eritrean refugees have also been attacked or destroyed, further displacing tens of thousands within Ethiopia, UNHCR warned. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Yes, listeners, yes, it's non-stop war, whether it's Ethiopia, Yemen, or the imperialist Russia, competing on how to turn their part of the world into rubble, as the United States imperialists, oh, we're so quick to forget, turned Iraq, large portions of Syria, and all of Libya into a war of cities of rubble. Let's call it a planet of rubble. Imperialists love turning things into rubble because it's good for job growth later if you survive, for the survivors. Oh, yeah. And not to be outdone, the German government, has came up with an ingenious idea. Let's triple their military budget after being called a pacifist government by most of the Western world. And MSNBC, the neoliberal network of choice among the people in the United States, they all basically said the same thing. Germany had past tense, a pacifist government. So the chancellor, president, prime minister, I don't know, I can't remember, I just watched the speech early last week say, well, we'll just triple our military budget and let's learn from the Dummkopfs in the Pentagon. Here's a good one. Here's a really a good one. Let's just arm the Ukrainians. We don't want to break NATO rules of engagement, so we'll just arm them with shoulder-launched missiles for both tanks and airplanes, like the Americanos, did in Afghanistan with Reagan. What is news here?
Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock has backed calls to investigate potential human rights violations committed by Russia in Ukraine. She was speaking via video link to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
We urgently need a commission of inquiry on Ukraine to investigate all violations of human rights that have been committed by Russia since its military aggression. We must stand strong on accountability.
Meanwhile, Germany has announced that it's sending more weapons to Ukraine. A government source says Berlin has agreed to provide 2,700 anti-aircraft missiles. The weapons are Soviet-designed Strela missiles from the stocks of the former East German armed forces. Germany had already committed to delivering 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 surface-to-air missiles. Berlin recently reversed a long-standing policy of not exporting weapons to conflict zones. Let's get some background on this from our chief political editor, Michaela Küchner. Michaela, these weapons are said to be of Soviet production from the former East German army. That's an irony of history, isn't it?
I think we're in the process of actually writing a new chapter in history. These are Soviet made, yes. They were delivered to the former East Germany. These are weapons that were also used in Russia's conflict with Afghanistan back then in the days. So they're very old, but they are functioning hardware, and that is scarce currently in the German army. And after initially we heard the defense minister Lamprecht saying, look, we have to look what we even have, what we can give out. Well, this now is part of a continuing list, because we do expect there to be more that can be given to Ukraine, always stressing that there's no direct handover. Germany is not delivering these weapons physically.
Does that make a difference for Russia? How is Russia viewing this? It's NATO weapons being used against them. I'm sure they're going to have something to say about it.
Well, these are specifically not weapons that are earmarked within NATO contingencies, and this actually is a key point. We heard the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia yesterday stressing that there's an increasing likelihood of misunderstandings of a direct contact between NATO and Russia, which fits into a Russian narrative of actually NATO being an active threat towards Russia, which NATO denies. It's a defense mechanism. And clearly, all NATO countries that are sending weapons are at pains to stress and to ensure that there is no direct contact, because that's what everybody wants to avoid, and that there would be a direct confrontation with Russia, which could, and, you know, I'm surprised I'm even saying this, but that is World War III scenario if that was to happen. So these are the stakes that are on the table at the moment.
Terrible stakes. The German government recently set up a special budget of 100 billion euros to ramp up defense, to modernize the German army, the Bundeswehr. And a fierce debate has now flared up in German politics about that. Can you bring us up to speed?
It's an internal debate. I mean, what we saw happening over the weekend is the Chancellor pretty much acting alone, turning around German defense and foreign policy of the past decades, and now effectively trebling the German defense budget overnight, which is quite something. I was with him as he traveled to Israel yesterday. There, that was received positively. Israel's now offered a new strategic dialogue. It so far only has with Britain and the US, and it shows that there's a new understanding of what strategic role Germany will have also in the future, and that it has to be able to defend itself because it's simply not able to do that. And this also fits in with the signals we're getting from the French President Emmanuel Macron, who's now stressing self-sufficiency is something that's needed in the future and an own strategic outlook. These are words we've heard before, but they're now being backed up by money, and it looks like infrastructure and hardware in the very near future as well.
Well, I think the money is the important sign. It always shows when people are serious. DW's chief political editor, Michaela Küchner, there for us. Thank you. And here are some more headlines related to this war. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, says his country will push on with its mission to, quote, demilitarize Ukraine and stop it joining NATO. Speaking on Russian television on Thursday, Lavrov accused Western countries of preparing for a war against Russia and raising the prospect of nuclear weapons. Police in Moscow have apparently detained a group of children for laying flowers at the Ukraine embassy. That's according to a social media user. Some were as young as seven. People were also arrested in St. Petersburg. A monitoring group says more than 8,000 anti-war protesters have now been detained in the past week in Russia. The International Paralympic Committee has banned Russian and Belarusian athletes from competing at the Paralympics. That reverses a previous decision just a day before the games begin in Beijing. On Tuesday, the IPC had said athletes from the two countries could take part as neutrals. German carmaker Volkswagen says it will stop exports to Russia and halt producing vehicles there. It joins several other car companies now boycotting Russia over Ukraine. Some of the world's biggest technology companies, clothing brands, and industrial giants have now cut all ties with Russia, while various shipping companies have stopped deliveries.
So, did you pick it up? By the way, the name of the shoulder-launched missiles, anti-tank and surface-to-air missiles, they're not called Stingers like we manufacture. We, the arms manufacturer, I think Raytheon makes the Stinger missile, shoulder launch missiles that went to Afghanistan that helped, Ronald Reagan help the Afghanistan. This is before we bombed and turned into rubble most of Iraq. Remember that? It's a long time ago. Afghanistan. Oh, my goodness. Well, the shoulder launch missiles manufactured by the East Germans, who knows how many years ago? I mean, what was it, 40 years ago? I'm surprised that they work, but they're called Strela, Strela. And they're for two kinds, both air, surface-to-air, and for 2,700 surface-to-air shoulder launch and 1,700 anti-tank shoulder launch from Germany. For being a pacifist government and a pacifist military, they certainly are outdoing themselves at this. Now, the prime minister, or if you notice, it was the chancellor. I got that wrong. The chancellor is the one that proposes tripling the military budget. That may not go quite so well with the German people who, in their four numbers, 100 to quarter million showed up to demonstrate for peace and against war. They didn't like Putin, but they certainly didn't want another World War II. They showed up from 100 to 250,000 in Berlin, really on a spot notice. I mean, very, very quickly. And I was very impressed with that. But not to be outdone. Oh, wait, as a show note, if those of you listening on Radio Free Kansas's Blog Talk Radio Network, the slideshow today, tonight, the slideshow for tonight's show is provided by Franz Messerl. He was an artist very poor artist who started, can you imagine this, using a chisel and chiseling woodcuts that he would use to stamp messages. He stamped novels that were called wordless novels from 1905 to after World War One. All of those slides appearing on the show are by the artist Franz Maswell, who created his own stamps, and later, after World War One, created his wordless novels, The Passion of Man and The City. Absolutely stunning graphics that tell a story. But these were, that you're seeing on the slideshow, were created by the artist Franz Maswell during and immediately after World War One. And I've added a notation. They're available as stamps that you can use. You can use them there. Those stamps are in public domain. I strongly urge listeners to, copy the stamps off the slideshow and have your own stamps and stamp them on your envelopes that go out to the mail and let people know the controversial nature of mass wars. Now, the BBC, never to be outdone, broadcast within the same 24-hour period, last week, this little nifty little clip. It's about 5.5 minutes long.
President Putin has ordered Russia's strategic nuclear forces to be placed on high alert. He says Western leaders have made aggressive statements about Russia. And he also says that international sanctions are illegitimate. Boris Johnson has described the move as a distraction from the reality of what's going on here in Ukraine, while the U.S. denounced it as completely unacceptable. Here's our Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg.
From the Kremlin, a pointed message to the West. Don't push Russia. President Putin summoned his military chiefs and gave them an order.
Top officials of leading NATO countries are making aggressive statements about our country. Therefore, I'm ordering the Minister of Defense and the Chief of the General Staff to put the strategic nuclear forces on special alert.
Would Putin really use them? He practiced a week ago, overseeing exercises of Russia's strategic deterrence forces. Typically unsubtle hints to America and NATO not to stand in his way over Ukraine. Today's special alert, more presidential muscle flexing. Across from the Kremlin, Muscovites gathered on a bridge to remember Boris Nemtsov, the Putin critic gunned down right here 7 years ago. For Vladimir Karamurza, this was a day for remembering a friend and for condemning the war.
This is not Russia's war. This is not a war by the Russian people and the Ukrainian people. This is yet another military adventure, military crime by an unelected, unaccountable, authoritarian, and frankly increasingly deranged dictator in the Kremlin by the name of Vladimir Putin.
You won't hear anything like that on Russian state TV. It's been claiming that Russian troops are liberating eastern Ukraine and that Moscow is using force in the interests of peace. In Russia, television remains the key tool for shaping public opinion. So if you control TV, as the Kremlin does, you control the messaging. But not 100%, because today many Russians do get their news and information online. And there, they see a very different picture.
So if you use the words attack, invasion, or war...
We can say only special operation.
Yevgenia Albats edits an online magazine. Like other independent Russian media, the authorities have banned it from calling this a war.
What is the Kremlin trying to do to the truth now in Russia?
What they always do. Well, they always... turn truth into lies. They lie They just lie.
Censorship at home. War abroad.
Yes, war in Ukraine, and now Russia's nuclear forces on special alert. Tonight, Russian state TV announced our submarines alone are capable of launching more than 500 nuclear warheads, guaranteed to destroy America and all of NATO. So what is this? Brinkmanship? Something more? Or something less? Empty threats? But I think after the dramatic events we've seen in recent days, it would be unwise to dismiss these signals from the Kremlin. But of course, for the international community, that leaves a very difficult question: how to react to them.
I'll be right back. I'm getting my notes together. I'll be right back after this short musical interlude. From the Middle East, they beat black medical students from Ukraine before letting them in. Quite interesting, the hypocrisy. Well, not to be outdone, Katie Halper. She's very interesting. She did a series of podcasts for quite a while with Matt Taibbi called Useful Idiots, but she struck out on her own. Matt Taibbi is writing a book, I believe, is what is his official excuse for leaving the Useful Idiots podcast. So she's out on her own. She's very interesting. I like her. She's brave. That's what I like. I like brave people. Outspoken, who aren't afraid to it. And here she had a short 10-minute of her discussion with Christopher Hedges. Now, this gives you a good step back and look at the big picture about what's happening in Ukraine and really what's going on.
I'm going to bring on our first esteemed guest. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who for 15 years was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, serving as the Middle East as well as the Balkan Bureau Chief. He previously worked overseas for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and NPR. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Katie.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
You have a great recent piece that caused a little bit of a fight among my friends and families. My family, my mom decided to text. She didn't do an email. She did like a mass text, a group text, and texted out your article. And so there were strong opinions, and we had to actually kill the chat because it was a little too hostile. But that's always a sign of a great writer, great ideas, very provocative ideas. But you have a very sensible, I would say, piece that sadly you can't find this perspective most places. It's at Shear Post, which is the website run by the great Bob Shear. It's called Chronicle of a War Foretold. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a near universal understanding among political leaders that NATO expansion would be a foolish provocation against Russia. How naive we were to think that the military-industrial complex would allow such sanity to prevail. You write, I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 reporting on the revolutions that overthrew the ossified communist dictatorships that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a time of hope. NATO, with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, became obsolete. President Mikhail Gorbachev reached out to Washington and Europe to build a new security pact that would include Russia. Secretary of State James Baker and the Reagan administration, along with the German foreign minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, assured the Soviet leader that if Germany was unified, NATO would not be extended beyond the new borders. The commitment not to expand NATO, also made by Great Britain and France, appeared to herald a new global order. We saw the peace dividend dangled before us, the promise that the massive expenditures on weapons that characterized the Cold War would be converted into expenditures on social programs and infrastructures that had long been neglected to feed the insatiable appetite of the military. So my first question for you is, what happened?
The arms industry saw a multi-billion-dollar bonanza, which was converting the militaries in the former communist bloc to be NATO compatible. And that's what happened. Now, every politician and statesperson that I spoke with, I mean, I can't think of anyone who advocated the expansion of NATO. I mean, the tragedy was that Gorbachev, Yeltsin, and we forget in the early years of Putin, there was an attempt, a very serious attempt on the part of Russia to build a joint security pact. We can't forget the trauma that Russia endured in the Second World War when the Nazis invaded all the way to Moscow and devastated that whole swath of the Soviet Union. Of course, that was repeated a century earlier by Napoleon. They have legitimate fears of being encircled. And this was the Tehran Conference, the primary issue between Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill was carving up Eastern Europe in a way to protect the Soviet Union, to make it feel secure. And both the Americans and the British realized that as a necessity. This was also true in 1989. But unfortunately, that was completely abandoned and there were a series of agreements. So you had the agreement not to expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany than the Clinton administration, and of course it did. There's now a missile base in Poland, 100 miles from the Russian border. Clinton then promised that he would not station NATO troops in Eastern Europe. We now have thousands of NATO troops in Eastern Europe. There was the Minsk agreement that nobody ever honored. There was a promise not to intervene in the internal affairs of border countries like the Ukraine. It wasn't honored. So what has happened, of course, is preemptive war, which is under post-Nuremberg law as a criminal war of aggression. There's no way around it. And Russia is guilty, but they were baited and they took the bait and they pulled the trigger. And that's kind of the tragedy of what's happened.
So were you surprised?
So a lot of people were predicting that he wouldn't go beyond the separatist regions. I think he overreached. I think he should have stayed in the separatist regions. But I wasn't surprised for this reason. I spent 20 years covering war, and I'm well aware of information or disinformation as being a fundamental component to war. So for instance, in the first Gulf War, when I was with the Marine Corps on the border with Kuwait, there was a huge propaganda, a black kind of information campaign to make the Iraqis think that it would be a seaborne, a coastal invasion, and it worked. They played around with days, you know, so the Iraqis were thrown off balance as to when it would happen. This is always true in war. And after the Nazis took Alsace Lorraine, they mounted these speakers and had a huge peace offensive. And so I didn't believe anything coming out of the Kremlin. Am I surprised that he did it? I'm surprised that he did it because I think it's really counterproductive. So on that, from a kind of strategic or tactical sense, yes. But I wasn't surprised that he was lying, because that's what every country on the inception of a war does.
You quote in your article, you quote a diplomatic
cable.
A cable that was obtained and released by WikiLeaks.
Right.
And it was dated February 1st, 2008, written from Moscow and addressed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff or NATO European Union Cooperative National Security Council, Russia Moscow Political Collective, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State. And you say that there was this understanding that expanding NATO risks an eventual conflict with Russia, especially over Ukraine.
Well, that's all in that cable. I mean, that was the general understanding. So I could have quoted George Kennan or all sorts of other people, but the cable is kind of interesting because they actually talk about how divisive NATO membership it would be to the Ukraine, what it would do to domestic politics, that it would create an opening for Russian intervention. This is 2008, that the Russian establishment would be encouraged to meddle in internal affairs in the Ukraine, and the U.S. would then meddle with opposing forces, and this would put, in their words, U.S. and Russia in a classic confrontational posture, and that's exactly where we are.
Right. It says in the memo, right, not only does Russia perceive encirclement by NATO and efforts to undermine Russia's influence in the region, but it also fears unpredictable and uncontrolled consequences, which would seriously affect Russian security interests. Experts tell us that Russia is particularly worried that the strong divisions in Ukraine over NATO membership, with much of the ethnic Russian community against membership, could lead to a major split involving violence or, at worst, civil war. And then you describe how it was for these reasons, right, among these reasons, that Obama blocked arms sales to Ukraine.
Yeah.
Which was
prudent and smart.
Right. And then, of course, reversed by Trump and then by Biden, because you had in this kind of unbelievable, but surely by now, I guess, believable and predictable move. But you saw these, you know, Democrats up in arms and accusing, you know, Trump of being a traitor, because they wanted him to reverse Obama's position, which he ultimately did, and then so did Biden. I mean, why do you think Obama took that prudent decision?
He understood that it was dumping gasoline on the conflict.
Right, but why do you think?
Because Biden failed at everything else. I mean, his presidency is a disaster. His opinion poll ratings are in the tank. You know, his Build Back Better bill is gutted. All of his promises, like forgiving student loans and raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, have been forgotten. The moratorium on foreclosures, the extended child tax credit, all the assistance that people got is now being terminated. So what's better than a war? Now we got the EU just announced that they're going to allocate hundreds of millions of euros to buy weapons. Germany just said it would triple its defense budget. Biden has asked Congress for $6.4 billion for the Ukraine. And this is on top of the $650 million in military aid that they've given the Ukraine. It's absolute insanity, especially because Russia is a nuclear power, as Putin reminded everyone. These kind of merchants of death who are making tons of money off of this and made tons of money off of expanding NATO are at this point, I mean, over dramatic, but they're flirting with a nuclear holocaust. It's just nuts.
Music and then comedy, and then I'll be back. by the way, that is the Clash, the immortal Clash. Joe Strummer won't care. He's dead. And frankly, I think it's absolutely fantastic the way he did it. Now, I'll tell you a story about a certain comedian after this three-minute clip.
You know the difference between the good and the evil in this world? The caring and the selfish, the Mel Gibson circa Lethal Weapon and the Mel Gibson circa Apocalypto? The difference is that bad people have plans. They always have a fucking plan. Good people don't have plans or missions or agendas. They just stumble through life thinking we'll all treat each other right if given the chance. Evil people have dry erase boards and PowerPoint presentations and iPad apps to keep track of just how the evil's coming along, whether it needs a course correction, because this quarter's evil is 3.5% lower than last quarter's. Good people don't have PowerPoints. Good people have donuts and word jumbles. For example, the billionaire Koch brothers funded a politician, Scott Walker, to become governor of Wisconsin. They knew that when he became governor, he would fake a budget crisis and he would act like it was the biggest budget crisis to ever hit the planet Earth. He would then pass a law that would destroy collective bargaining, the linchpin for unions. Hidden in that same law would be a provision that allows the Koch brothers to buy state-owned utilities for almost nothing, with no oversight. Both these things would make insane amounts of money for the Koch brothers. And on top of that, without union donations, very few Democrats would be able to get elected against the billions in corporate donations going to Republicans. With mostly Republicans winning elections, the Koch brothers would be able to purchase more and more of America. Now that's what I call a fucking plan. So that's what the evil people were thinking. During all this time, what were the non-evil people thinking? Man, do I like ravioli. Especially in cream sauce. If I work an extra hour at the shop, I bet I could buy 2 cans of ravioli instead of just the uno. That's what they were thinking. Bad people have plans. We don't have plans. I don't have a plan. You don't have a plan. Your plan was I'm going to watch internet videos. Meanwhile, Halliburton's plan was to cause a military coup in the sovereign country of Eritrea, a place neither you nor I ever knew existed. But they know, because they also have maps. They have dry erase boards and maps. I'm just saying the good people on this planet are never going to get the upper hand until we get some f***ing office supplies up in here.
That was Lee Camp. And he had a show, called Redacted Tonight up until this week. And because it was on RT America, or maybe it was the budget, I don't know, but his show has been canceled at leecamp.net. I'll put another one on by him later in the show if we have time. And he's hilarious. Lee Camp once came through Kansas City, and, you know, I talked with him. I didn't go to his show. Because, why? Because I told Lee, I said, on email, and then I said, oh, I had him on the show. I had him on Radio Free Kansas. And there was a young man, I can't remember his name, but he was one of the few union activists here in Kansas who got fired, basically, because he was trying to organize a union, in my opinion. And I felt sorry for the guy. So I told Lee on air when he came on Radio Free Kansas, and I had the guy call in and talk about his plight, and Lee gave him a free ticket if he could make it to Kansas City to come to his show. So Lee Camp and I go way, way back. That's before he had Redacted Tonight, which he did for several years up until this week, and he lost his funding for his comedy show. It's leecamp.net if you'd like to contact him or send him $5 or something, you know, whatever you want to do. He's a wonderful comedian. I really like him. I want to read some of my notes, but first I want to get I want to get the actual stuff together that I want to read. This is the latest stuff, and then we got a long clip I'll play at the end. Hold on, after this music, I'll get right with my most recent notes.
Heaven anymore, they're already overcrowded from your dreams. got my windshield so filled with flags I couldn't see. So I ran the car upside a curb, right into a tree. By the time they got a doctor down, I was already dead. And I'll never understand why the man standing in the pearly gates said to me. I wrote this song about 35 years ago. And I sang it for a long time, and then I had it stuffed and I hung it up above my mantle. It had been real good to me and everything, you know, but I think it had outlived its usefulness then. Every once in a while I put some Lemon Pledge on it and just dust it off a little bit. But within the last year or so, I got a letter from the President of the United States asking for this song. It seems he got nostalgic for his draft dodging days. But you two like me, I won't get you in heaven anymore. We're already overcrowded from eternity to the Lord. Now Jesus don't like us, no matter what the reason's for. And you flag the cow won't be you in the heaven anymore.
The immortal John Prine. I'll give you about 5 minutes of my most recent notes I've taken in the last 10 hours of monitoring the news. The BBC has reported today, and it's the current talk among the chattering classes, that Anthony Blinken, I think that's his first name, Anthony Blinken, he's the appointed, I think he's the head of the State Department, was in Moldova today, and he was proudly announcing that they were going to have Poland. Now take this shit. They're going to have. It's like they took a lesson from the Germans, you know. He was going to have Poland give the old around. The best I could tell is about 25 MiG fighters. Once again, dating from the East German days. To Ukraine. And they will replace them with U.S. aircraft. I'm going to put on some music, and I'll be right back with you.
We want to do a poem for one of our unfavored people, who's now the head of the Nixon campaign. He was formerly the attorney general named John Mitchell. Nixon's campaign seems to be out, you know, getting off on a rather hip foot after his trip to China in the name of peace, while they were killing people right across the street, so to speak, in North and South Vietnam. But No Knock, the law in particular, was allegedly legislated for black people rather than, you know, for their destruction. And it means simply that authorities and members of the police force no longer have to knock on your door before entering. They can now knock your door down. It's No Knock.
It to me, I must admit, but just for the record, you were talking shit. Long rap about No Knock being legislated for the people you've always hated in this hellhole that we call home. No Knock, the man will say, to keep that man from beating his wife. No Knock, the man will say, to protect people from themselves. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. No Knock. No knocked on my brother Fred Hampton, bullet holes all over the place. No knocked on my brother Michael Harrison, jammed a shotgun against his skull. For my protection, who's gonna protect me from you? The likes of you, the nerve of you, to talk that shit face to face, your tomato face deadpan, your deadpan deadening another freedom plan. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. But if you're wise, no-knocker, you'll tell your no-knocking lackeys, ha! No knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, no knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, and double lock your door, because soon someone may be no-knocking, ha, ha, for you. No knock, to be slipped into John Mitchell's suggestion box.
Boy, it just goes on and on. I mean, the crimes of U.S. imperialism and now Russian imperialism is just nonstop. I mean, the wars, turning cities into rubble as a strategy for war, it really only helps the armament factories and the oligarchs, the plutocrats, the rich, the extremely rich. That's all it helps. Why do we participate in it? Once again, the slideshow on tonight's show, it's from a guy who goes way back. He was banned by the Nazis, by the way, in 1933, but he goes way back in World War One. The slides on the slideshow are pictures of woodcuts. He cut these out of wood with a chisel and made these stamps. And they're in the public domain. You can use them, steal the images and use them. They're in the public domain. You're not stealing anything. So Blinken is going to have Poland give their old MiG jet fighters to Ukraine, and dig this, he's willing to replace them. He's going to replace them with the United States aircraft. I mean, talk about money. Money, money, money. There's also another one. Now, this is from France 24, the news media, that they're going to base you, that it's said by Russian defense, the spokesman person for the Russian defense in Moscow, that they're alleging that Ukraine aircraft are being based in Romania, and it could broaden the war into other countries. This is not good stuff, really. And I'll be back with you at the end. I'm going to give you this long, it's really good. I hope I got the right clip here. It was broadcast Friday, and it was from the point of view of an American soldier who named Mark Sloboda. I'm not good at this. Sloboda, who is a military foreign affairs analyst based in Moscow. And it's very interesting. Let's see if it's the right one. Russia now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anya Parampil, and this is Red Lines. My guest today is Moscow-based international affairs analyst Mark Sloboda. Mark, welcome back to Red Lines.
Hi, Anya. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Red Lines.
I wanted to start by getting your reaction to really what I've noticed is the mainstream line in U.S. corporate media. I'm hearing this from hosts, as well as politicians across the political spectrum, whether that's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi or Florida Senator Marco Rubio. They're coming on the air in the United States and claiming that Putin really expected to have taken Ukraine completely by now, that he's surprised that this is taking so long, and that he was expected to be welcomed as a liberator in Ukraine. That's the line that we're getting in the United States. How do you respond to that? Is it accurate?
Yeah, it's partly accurate, I think. Yeah. I think that certainly the Russian military made a lot of mistakes in the early days of the campaign. I think the Russian government doesn't believe, the Russian military does not believe that they're at war with the Ukrainian people, right? They're going in to protect some Ukrainian people against other Ukrainian people, right? The people of Donbas who have been shelled for 8 years because they didn't want to accept the overthrow of their government, their democratically elected government that they overwhelmingly voted for 8 years ago by a, you know, openly foreign U.S. and European back push that was violent and unconstitutional and overthrew the presidents they elected. Not that the president they elected was, you know, not flawed and necessarily a good guy, but they elected him as the lesser of two evils to prevent the guys that seized power from being elected. Russia is there to protect not only its national security interests, of course, as they watch the ongoing de facto on the ground NATOization of Ukraine, turning it into a military outpost of the United States, of NATO, you know, directly targeting Russia with the construction of UK military bases, some 10,000 NATO trainers and advisors, flooding the country with NATO weapons. No country would allow this, right? This is a Cuban Missile Crisis existential moment for Russian security. But they are also there. I mean, they have been trying to get the regime in Kiev to fulfill the Minsk Accords that it agreed to 7 years ago, that supposedly everyone agrees to. But, Kiev regime tells its own people that it will never, ever fulfill them openly. And that was supposed to politically reconcile the country, a ceasefire in Donbass, protect the people there, ensure that the political and cultural rights of the people of East Ukraine are respected, and it was enshrined in the UN Security Council resolution that everyone, including the United States, agreed to, but refused to, everyone knew that Kiev would never fulfill it. Russia doesn't view themselves as an enemy of the Ukrainian people, certainly not the East Ukrainian people. They're there to protect some Ukrainians from others and to protect their own security interests, to remove a regime that seized power in 2014 unconstitutionally and violently, and to, as they say, denazify the country. And what they mean by that, I think, would be better said as de-banderize the country, because it's the unique Ukrainian Western Ukrainian ultra-nationalist Banderite fascism. And there's not really a question. I mean, it's often used as, oh, how can Ukraine be a neo-Nazi country if they have a Jewish leader? Yes, Zelensky is of Jewish descent. So is the oligarch who is his patron, Kolomoisky, who funded these battalions from the very beginning of the Maidan, as openly admitted in Ukrainian press, right? Azov, the right sector, C-14, these are indisputed neo-Nazi death squads, right? And you don't get to call yourself a democratic president. You have state-supported and armed neo-Nazi death squads sent to kill your own people into subjugation, whether you are of Jewish descent or not, right? It is absolutely absurd the amount of whitewashing and apologia that has gone out on this. You even heard Evelyn Farkas, a former Obama-era Pentagon official, who, admitted in an article just over a month and a half ago in the Daily Beast, that they may be far right, but their ideology really doesn't matter because the Kiev regime is in an existential fight. I mean, how can you say that their fascist ideology doesn't matter? So yes, that is it's by far just these battalions. I just posted a few days ago a excerpt from a RADA, the Ukrainian Parliament, celebration list for 2022 to 2023. And it reads as a celebration of Holocaust perpetrating Nazi collaborators in Ukrainian history, where they celebrate them one day after another.
Wow.
So that is, and you can go to my page and I can link you to the original. I mean, this isn't a joke. When they say that the Ukrainian government, they're not neo-Nazi. No, they're not neo-Nazi. They are old school Banderite fascist Nazi.
And they're not trying to hide it.
They're not trying to hide it. The number two person In Petro Poroshenko's European Solidarity Party is Andrei Perubi, who I know that you know because Max, you know, tried to confront U.S. officials, U.S. politicians, when they were fetching him. You know, a literal, I mean, again, he's not really a neo-Nazi. He's an old school Nazi. And he was the one who was responsible, all indication, including from Canadian, Ukrainian-Canadian researchers, show that he was the one. He hired the snipers that fired on both police and protesters, creating this sacralizing moment on the Maidan. So that is one of Russia's goals going in, to denazify, demilitarize, remove this regime, protect the people of East Ukraine, and yes, push NATO back out. On what they bombed on the first day was all military infrastructure. It was all bases and infrastructure that had been refurbished, funded by NATO, for use by NATO in Ukraine. But as some top Western military establishment analysts, the guys who know the Russian military and know the situation best, and called it, like I did actually, back in November, of what was going to happen, they have come out and said, and I'm talking Michael Kaufman at CNES, I'm talking Rob Lee at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, also an Alpha Fellow, they say that one of the mistakes that the Russian military has made is they have gone in way too soft in the first few days with only a fraction of their troops in the first 4 or 5 days of the assembled troops that they had. They didn't use any of the heavy weapons that the Russian military is so good at and famous for. They barely used artillery, which is a major facet of the Russian military. They limited airstrikes to a handful. They didn't use fighter bombers. They didn't use electronic warfare. I'm sure you've noticed that the Ukrainian internet and meme machine is up and working like a pro. And not only that, according to these guys, you don't have to trust me, trust the Western military analysts on this. Not only did they try to minimize Ukrainian civilian casualties, they were trying, counterintuitively, they say, to minimize Ukrainian military casualties, trying to get them to surrender, to lay down their arms, say, we're not here to fight you. We want to get rid of this regime that seized your country. And they had good reason, I guess, to believe this because of what happened in 2014. The Ukrainian military, after the putsch, essentially evaporated. They didn't follow orders from the new regime, right? They, when the few responsive Ukrainian military units arrived in the Donbas to suppress the terrorists, as they were being called, they were greeted by ordinary people of East Ukraine who came out onto the streets and tried physically to stop their tanks. They just gave up and went home, and their military unit was disbanded. And the far-right battalions were brought in to artillery shell Donbas from a distance, where no one had to see what was being done. So at that time, most of the Ukrainian military either defected or just quit and went home. And again, you don't have to trust my word for it, right, because I'm in Moscow. Trust Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. They did a report on this, which is up online. It's a video report. They say that 75% of the Ukrainian Navy defected or quit. 75%.
Wow.
Yeah. And most of them went to Crimea and of course, to Russia. Because that's where the Ukrainian naval bases were. And the Russian military was expecting a repeat of that scenario, or at least troops laying down their arms. But it didn't happen. And while the Ukrainian military is still almost entirely a conscript military at, you know, the lower levels, And a lot of those are East Ukrainian boys who don't want to be there. The Kiev regime has been extremely successful in the last 7 years at purging their military and putting in a lot of much more ideologically committed people into these roles. And when I say that, I mean a lot of West Ukrainians who rabidly hate Russia and also don't think much of East Ukrainians, to be honest, either. We've already talked about these neo-Nazi battalions, Azov and the Right Sector, but as well as having their own discrete battalions and political movements and entirely comprising the National Guard, they have been fully integrated into the Ukrainian military, police, and security services. And they're spread out so that effectively they serve as political commissars. And they control the flow of information to the Ukrainian conscripts and troops. They're pretty brutal when anyone ever suggests they don't want to be there or they don't want to fight or so on. But I think also that, years of the Kiev regime's control of the media through the corporate, through the oligarchs that control the media in the country have convinced a lot of people that, despite the fact that all of East Ukraine politically in elections, even since the Maidan, does not support Maidan politicians, but that Russia is being seen as an invader. Now, we're going to see the results in a few days, because despite these initial mistakes of going in too soft, and as the American military analysts, not doing what the American military would have done, which is a shock and awe campaign, that they have corrected these mistakes. They have moved more Russian forces in. They have increased the use of heavy weapons slightly, although they're still far below what they could do and using the most damaging weapons, the most indiscriminate. They have taken basically the entire southeastern coast of Ukraine, liberated the cities there. The last holdout is Mariupol. And Mariupol is happening right now as we speak. And that is going to be a bloodbath, because Mariupol is the headquarters of Azov. Azov was put there because Mariupol almost went to the DNR when the original whole Russian spring happened in the east as a response to the Maidan there. So it's going to be a bloody fight. But once Mariupol is cleansed of Azov, then there is a complete line from all along the southeast, from Donetsk all the way to the Dnieper River. Meanwhile, the Russian military has encircled Kharkov, the second largest city of Ukraine in the northeast, also which theoretically should have a more Russian-friendly population. We'll see how much that bears out. They will then basically have created a cauldron, an encirclement, pinning the majority of the Ukrainian troops, the Ukrainian armed forces, the Kiev regime, in the east of the country, where they can hopefully force more of them to surrender without having to resort to killing large numbers of them. Meanwhile, the encirclement of Kiev is also effectively complete. They are doing what they can to do targeted strikes right now. They took out the headquarters of the Ukrainian intelligence unit, the SBU, which even Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch reported on for torturing essentially random East Ukrainians that they were picking off of streets and just torturing because everyone in East Ukraine was against them, at least as far as 2014. But I think the Russian government did expect a much quicker operation that would be not dirty, that is what they hoped for, that they could do a decapitation strike against regime in Kiev, remove Zelensky, and, you know, restore the constitutional order to the country that they see as ripped up in 2014 with the overthrow of Yanukovych. It didn't quite work it out that way, but there has been a course correction. And while, you know, they are still showing much, much more carrot than stick, despite the propaganda machine, and despite the fact being amplified by the U.S. mainstream media machine, there's no question that the regime in Kiev is winning the information war. They are a meme machine. I mean, I'm sure you've heard one example. I'm sure you've heard the story of Snake Island.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Where supposedly there was 13 or 18 brave Ukrainian naval infantry that on a small island that is basically just a little naval station, when confronted by a Russian warship that wanted them to surrender, they replied back, F you, Russian warship. And then the Russian warship commenced to pound them and they all died heroically. And Zelensky awarded them all Heroes of Ukraine medals. And, you know, social media banners have gone up celebrating them, and T-shirts were printed, and Western media were printing articles about how FU Russian warship has replaced Slava Ukraina, the ultra-nationalist OUN slogan that has become the slogan of the new Ukraine. The problem is none of that is true, and the Kiev regime has now been forced to admit that. There were actually 83 naval infantry on that island. They all surrendered right away. They had been abandoned. They were promised that they would be rescued. They never were. They surrendered right away. They have been treated well, with respect. They've signed papers that they won't participate in hostilities, and they're going to be returned to their families. They've done interviews, and they were crying at how they were, you know, their families were lied to that they were dead and that they were heroes, and that this whole thing has been used as a big propaganda machine to keep people fighting.
You're right that Ukraine's absolutely winning the PR war, and having a president who's actually an actor, I'm sure, helps in that regard. Yes. But you mentioned the Russians were hoping that this war wouldn't become dirty, Mark. And I have to say, another major theme that we hear on U.S. networks is an acknowledgement across the board again that the United States itself cannot afford to engage with Russia in Ukraine or intervene in an obvious way. And yet we know that Biden has already approved at least $350 million of military equipment to go to Ukraine, even though the Ukrainian military isn't totally functional right now. That raises the question, where are the weapons going? And recently in U.S. media, it was openly reported, even before this latest military operation, that the United States, since 2015, has been covertly training paramilitaries in Ukraine to respond to a Russian entry into the country. And to me, this sounds like there is a potential for the United States to encourage a Syria-style dirty war in Ukraine on Russia's border. How worried are you about that scenario?
I'm extremely worried. And actually, this didn't take place in Ukraine. It actually took place in the south of the United States.
Yep.
It's been reported, I think, in the Daily Beast and Politico. The CIA ground branch paramilitary started training the Ukrainian far right because they're the most ideologically committed to hating Russia in 2015, because they figured that at some point this would happen, that Russia would intervene. And they have a long history of this, because in the early days of the Cold War, in the late 40s, early 50s, the CIA armed West Ukrainian insurgents who had just finished being Nazi collaborators to wage an insurgency in Western Ukraine against the Soviet Union. And part of West Ukrainian national identity is to hate Russians. I mean, flat out. That's probably the primary component of it. And there's historical and cultural reasons for this, because West Ukraine wasn't even part of Ukraine up until the late 1930s. They were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. They have a different religion. They're Catholic units than the Orthodox Eastern Ukrainians and even Central Ukrainians. And, you know, they hated leftism. They went fascist, as much of Eastern Europe did in the interwar period. And their heroes were the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, and others. And they collaborated with the Nazis in World War II. They wanted their own independent Ukraine, an independent fascist Ukraine. They were responsible for perpetuating the Holocaust against not just Jews, but massacres of Poles, Eastern Ukrainians, leftists, you know, communists throughout the country, of course, with such fervor that, you know, documented archived evidence, the Nazis were even a little taken back. They're like, whoa, you know, calm down a bit there. The stories are really not fit, you know, for telling on any medium, really, and it'll probably get you even more banned from YouTube or whatever you are on now than you already are. But you know, if you're interested, you can read the historical documents of the crimes of the OUN and the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists and the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. But that is a very different national identity conception from Eastern Ukrainians, who see themselves largely as the same people. Yes, that is what President Putin has said, but polls show that's actually also what the people of Eastern Ukraine feel. And it's also what Zelensky, originally from Dnepropetrovsk in East Ukraine, also said when he was campaigning, although he has certainly reversed himself on that now. He's a hostage of the regime he inherited, and I think that he has internalized a lot of it. But when you have a Jewish descent president pinning a Hero of Ukraine medal on a right sector neo-Nazi fighter on New Year's Eve and proclaiming him a Hero of Ukraine for killing other Ukrainians, there's a word for that. It's a capo. It's all pretty Orwellian. But there will be an insurgency in West Ukraine. Just like if the Maidan had gone the other way, there still would have been a civil war in Ukraine. But it would have been fought in West Ukraine. That is essentially what will happen now. I don't even know if the Russian military will go into West Ukraine, because there, while in East Ukraine, there are hopes that some 60-70% of the population will either support the Russian troops or be apathetic about their presence. To be said, 30% opposed is still a lot when you're talking an insurgency. But in West Ukraine, it would be like 93% opposed. It would be toxic to go there. I don't know what they're going to do with West Ukraine. I hope they have a better plan, because I can't really imagine one. They could attempt to partition the country, which might actually be the best thing for Eastern Ukrainians, the way Germany was partitioned in the first Cold War, because we are in a new Cold War now. I mean, you understand the relations are not going to go back. We are looking at a great decoupling. Yes. Yes. But the U.S. and Europe are going to flood Western Ukraine with weapons. And Russia and Eastern Ukrainians, once they're re-elevated, re-empowered, to from the way they've been repressed for the last few years, and Eastern Ukrainian politicians, possibly even Yanukovych, or I'm not sure that would be a good idea, are put in as a transition government to restore constitutional order, they'll have to deal with that as well. And I think you're looking at a forever war in Ukraine, of civil conflict, of proxy conflict. I don't think it's going to go away in our lifetimes.
I guess I wasn't expecting to come to you for an optimistic view, but you don't think that there's any way that some peaceful negotiated solution will come out of this? I suppose the U.S. just won't allow it. They're going to continue to send weapons.
Look, you don't John Mearsheimer talked exactly about this. In fact, he's recently come out. John Mearsheimer is one of the great international relations scholars of all time. He's required reading International Relations 101, Tragedy of Great Power Politics. And, you know, you cannot agree with everything he says, but he has done videos on this. They're online. They're on YouTube. I've posted them online, saying because of how national identity divided Ukraine was and how important to Russian national security and history, that if the U.S. expanded NATO and intervened to try to exploit divisions in Ukraine and bring into power a anti-Russian, pro-Western government that would, take the country into NATO, that it would completely destabilize the country and completely destabilize Europe and thus the world. This is exactly what he's talked about. He warned about it. George Kennan, the architect of containment against the Soviet Union, said the same thing. U.S. Ambassador to Russia, John Matlock, said the exact same thing. I've posted them on my page, but you can find them also online. And it is exactly what has happened. You have these post-Soviet countries that have mixed populations left over from the Soviet Union, you know, with very different ethnicities, religions, and conceptions of national identity. You try to exploit those divisions to bring to power anti-Russian governments from what had been neutral countries. And remember, Ukraine was neutral up until 2014, right? The Ukrainian presidents, corrupt as they were, beholden to the oligarchs, they tried to maintain the internal and external balance between East and West in Ukraine. And that was completely broken in 2014, right? When you had the ideological conception of West Ukrainians forced hard on East Ukraine. I mean, shelling, 15,000 dead, Odessa massacre, Azov and right sector hard. And you can't put this country back together. I mean, I've seen articles by the Atlantic Council saying that the identity divisions, the idea of a divided Ukraine is a myth. It's just absolutely absurd. It's unscholarly. It has no relation to reality at all. I was doing work in the London School of Economics, doing a crisis scenario for NATO, for the NATO Council, dealing with a civil war in Ukraine back in 2010, because everyone saw this coming. In Ukraine, there were science fiction conventions about the future civil war in Ukraine.
Wow.
And that's what the U.S. stepped into, poured gasoline and money and weapons and fire on. You can't put this back together. There's too many dead. The best hope was the Minsk Accords, which was a Bosnia-Herzegovina, type solution. But the Kiev regime refused it because the U.S. and, France and Germany refused to push them on it because they are committed that Ukraine is geopolitically flipped to their side, and they are no longer content with a neutral Ukraine if that means Ukraine has to burn. If that means they have to kill each other, they'll fight Russia down to the last Ukrainian conscript, West Ukrainian, ultra-nationalists that they can throw at them. And they're doing it right now by continuing to flood the country with weapons. And it's not just the Americans anymore. The Swedish are doing it, right? The Finns. The U.S. has levered its powers against Europe. They have levered its massive economic power because they obviously have complete control of every corporation in the United States working in symbiosis to put the sanctions that they have on Russia.
Yeah, let's get into the sanctions, because President Biden took aim at Russian oligarchs during his State of the Union address.
The Russian people hate the Russian oligarchs. Not that they're really oligarchs so much, because Putin removed them from political power. They're effectively stewards. now, right? But they serve at the interests of the state, as it were. And I've seen Michael McFaul posting, just like Michael McFaul does, the former U.S. ambassador for Obama to Russia. I want to tell all of my rich Russian friends to run and take your money with you. You know, the Russian people are not going to be terribly upset if rich Russian elite are persecuted and their property is taken away by the United States. I hate to tell you.
What about the impact of the decision to de-link or unlink 7 Russian banks from the SWIFT system?
Yeah. They specifically did not.
They left out energy messaging.
They left out the banks that the Europeans need to pay Russia for the energy that keeps them alive, of course. Right. It's big. I mean, there's so many sanctions operating together here. The SWIFT, the attacks on the Russian central bank, and Russia, unlike the United States.
Russian flights as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, we're looking at a divided world now because we're talking airlines, and all European countries have banned any Russian airlines from entering their airspace. Okay. Cell phone here. Russia has turned around, of course, and banned every European airline. There's a lot more of Russian airspace comprising half the globe. A third of the globe. Sorry, it's a sixth technically, but it's pretty big. And, flights to Asia now just became a bankruptcy for European airlines. And we're looking at so much decoupling economically, politically, socially, physically, in terms of shipping containers and air flights. We're looking at a new Cold War, right? And it's not just against Russia, of course. It's also against China. And the United States has already announced that it is going to punish China severely for not turning on Russia, which was just silly in the first place. We're looking at a new, the unipolar moment is dead, absolutely. And you should remember right now, because it is going to be the pivot point in history for the rest of our lives. But the multipolar world is stillborn because of the U.S. trying so hard to hang on to that hegemonic moment. And their pressure on Russia and China and Iran and a host of other countries is pushing them to cooperate together in a way that no one ever, well, they should have expected, and I predicted it, but a lot of people said it wasn't going to happen. Right. And we're looking at a new bipolar world. We are now, as of 2 days ago, in a bipolar world, just a few decades after the last one ended.
As someone who's covered Venezuela very closely over the last few years, this is also something that I've been very focused on and seeing it with my own eyes and meeting with high-level diplomats from Russia and from around the world. This is the number one theme, that they were as a river all flowing naturally to one point of working together, because even though these systems are ideologically different from Russia to China to Iran to Venezuela, Turkey even, they all experience similar threats, and we're really focused on building a world, an alternative financial structure.
Survival.
One that doesn't depend on the U.S. and Europe. But what you've just described doesn't sound like it's going to work out for Europe or average Europeans very well. How is this going to impact the economy there? And it seems like figures such as Olaf Scholz have signed a death warrant on their political careers.
Yeah, I think that everyone should expect that we will be facing a global recession, if not depression, because of the extent of the Western sanctions that were put on Russia. And however, these, you know, accounts of Russian GDP without taking into account personal purchasing power parity, that try to say that Russia is smaller than Italy economically, it's ridiculous. It's pegged to a dollar value. It has no relation to reality. Russia is the biggest producer in the world of wheat, exporter in the world of wheat and several other grains. They're the biggest exporter of gas in the world. They are either the number two or number one, depending on the year, exporter of oil to the world. They're one of the major exporters of titanium to the world. They supply 40% of the world's fertilizer. You're trying to cut them off from the global market. You're creating a situation where all of those commodities that the whole world needs at a time when there's already shortages as a result of coming out of the pandemic. The price of oil just today skyrocketed to over $100 a barrel and is keeping going. The price of gas just skyrocketed to record highs. It's over $2,300 per 1,000 cubic meters in Europe, which was already gas shy. That is like 1,000% increase on a year ago. And they use that to heat and power their industry, to heat their homes and power their industry. The price of wheat just skyrocketed to the highest it has ever been. The price of aluminum, a big Russian resource, which the U.S. needs for its planes and so much of its industry, higher than it's ever been. And there's no reason for any of this to come down anytime soon. And this will all mean huge inflation, prices at the pump, prices increasing in everything in the United States because they require on gasoline so much for distribution, and the cost of the world food supply. In the first world, this will mean severe inflation and belt tightening for everyone. In the third world, this will mean starvation. You have countries like Egypt that get like 60% of their wheat from Russia.
I remember during the Arab Spring, it's what initially sparked off a lot of those demonstrations
food,
in Egypt.
Food scarcity. Yes.
Because of massive fires in Russian wheat fields,
yes.
Correct?
That was an exacerbating factor, I would say. Yes.
Yeah.
That was a year where climate change hit Russia really hard, and there were big fires across the country, a lot like you see in California and the Western United States. Russia is suffering from the same thing, and it resulted in a really bad wheat harvest, which led to all kind of political instability in North Africa. Again, I don't want to say that it caused it, but it was
right. There were obviously multiple factors,
yeah,
but
a big exacerbating factor because people were going hungry.
Right.
And actually, when they talked to people on the ground in Egypt during, you know, this overthrow of one dictator replacing him with the Islamists, replacing him with another dictator. Actually, what most people were protesting out there is they wanted bread.
Yeah. And now we're seeing, just to shift the conversation a little bit away from Europe, China saying that it's willing to step in and mediate between Russia and Ukraine. What factor do you think China has played in Putin's decision-making, and also just
yep.
What do you make of its response since the launch of this military operation?
Look, China is playing the diplomatic political game, you know, as, you know, it presents itself, as Russia usually does, as trying to be upholding of international law. And they're very worried about, you know, setting a precedent or a hypocritical note in their own discussions because of, you know, the U.S. promoting separatism of Taiwan from China. But to tell you what China's real position in all of this, it's been leaked that Chinese media has been given very strict terms of how it should refer to what is going on in Russia. Invasion is out. there's a whole host of framing words, right? And, you know, framing words are part of the media game. When the U.S. invades a country, it's an intervention. When someone else does it, it's an invasion. That is, you know, the way the propaganda machines all over the world work, whether you're in the United States, in Russia, or in China. But also, there was a recent article in the New York Times that reveals that a few months ago, back in December, I believe, the U.S. had intelligence of the Russian military buildup. That was quite obviously happening, and I was talking a lot about on Sputnik and elsewhere, and I said there was going to be an intervention, whereas everyone else there was, it's not going to happen, and
right.
So on. But they're not military. I'm ex-military, so anyway, so they went to China with this intelligence, and they said, hey, you know, this is going to really destabilize stuff, and we want you to help stop Russia. And they're doing this to the country that they have, they are in a full-on economic war with in terms of trade, tariffs, sanctions. They're parading U.S. military fleets up and down off the Chinese coast and the Taiwanese Straits and the South China Sea, creating the Quad, corralling India and Australia into their war. I mean, this is all going on. They're building up military forces and missiles in the Pacific. But, hey, help us out with this thing with your strategic partner, would you? So what did China do? They took the, according to the New York Times, they took the intelligence right to Russia, and they said, hey, this is what they know. Adjust your plans. So that is, I mean, pay attention. Everyone knows that the way China does diplo speak at the United Nations and their official pronouncements, but also take a look at their actions and what's going on behind the scene to know their real position. The Russian government and the Chinese government, Putin and Xi Jinping, are completely coordinated on this, and it has obviously been in the works, you know, at least as a fallback if the diplomatic pressure and this, you know, trying to get the security guarantees and the Minsk Accords finally implemented failed.
What do you make of India in all of this? India abstained from the UN Security Council resolution to condemn Russia. Even the United Arab Emirates initially abstained. I saw in the most recent vote that switched, they voted in favor.
Israel also refused to sanction. They voted against, but they refused to sanction Russia as well. For India, of course, you know, there's a long history of very friendly ties between India and the Soviet Union, and that had carried on originally to a very strong degree with Russia. There's a great deal of particularly military technical cooperation between Russia and India. Russia still provides something like 65% of India's weapons. The U.S. is definitely hedging in on that market, and Russia's not happy about it as India gets closer to the United States. And ties between Russia and India are not what they were. And India is not happy about Russia becoming effectively an alliance with China, and the United States and Russia is not happy with India crawling into bed with the United States, joining this Quad and so on. They want all of Eurasia to be united against U.S. hegemony. But, you know, there's still lingering good relations, and they don't want to ruin what relationships they have. India has a long history of voting with, shall we say, the rest, multipolar world voice at the UN with China, whom, you know, we all know they have a lot of disagreements with, but they have been a strong multipolar world vote at the UN. And although that is usually in favor of sovereignty when talking about U.S. invasions and regime changes around the world, India, the Indian government is well aware of what happened in Ukraine in 2014 and the extenuating circumstances there of the U.S. meddling. They've been under U.S. sanctions and threat of U.S. sanctions themselves, and there's a degree of understanding extended to Russia. They can't come out with full-throated support because U.S. economic pressure, that, you know, the blackmail threat of sanctions is so high on every country in the world right now. To get in line with this, that the best they could do is abstain. But they know full well what would happen if they had voted against Russia, because the Pakistani Prime Minister, Imran Khan, flew into Moscow on the day that the intervention was launched. And he said, upon landing and speaking to the press, it's so interesting to be here when there's so much excitement going on, and proceeded to sign a whole host of economic deals with Russia on gas and wheat and so on. And it's a card that great powers play with each other. If India gets too close to the U.S., Russia will become better friends with Pakistan, which is already good friends with China, and so on. It's great power politics. And so there are both, you know, ideological multipolar world reasons and practical great power politics reasons why India has abstained and will continue to stay out of this. And let's face it, with India, China, and Pakistan not siding with the U.S. on this and offering, you know, understanding or support for Russia in this, that's already like half the world.
I want to end this conversation by going back to the beginning and thinking about how we got to this point. I'm curious your analysis on this question that's really been in my head since the military operation began. As you've already alluded to, for months, Russia has been making troop movements within its own borders, which people, including yourself, did say appeared to be leading up to this kind of intervention in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the United States was, through its media and intelligence services, hyping up this threat of war. And
they were right for once.
Right. But I felt as though they were using it to undermine dialogue, to undermine discussions, and to say, well, that's why we need Ukraine and NATO. That's why we shouldn't be sitting down with the Russians in Geneva and continuing these talks. So at a certain point, Putin was bluffing, but he had to follow through. And I'm wondering when you think that shift took place, because obviously in the United States, a lot of people were looking at this just from the perspective of disbelief or mistrust for U.S. intelligence services, but maybe not totally understanding the way the Russian military and state works, and that it was actually very possible that they would go ahead with this kind of operation.
So Russia has been pushing for 7 long years to get the Kiev regime to implement the Minsk Accords that would politically reconcile the country between the Kiev regime and the people of East Ukraine from the events of 2014. It would federalize the country, or at least the Donbass portion, provide protection for their cultural, political, language rights, but it would also allow them to have effective veto power on Ukrainian foreign policy, as would the rest, you know, of the other areas of the country. So that would restore Ukraine to the neutrality that it had before 2014. It couldn't join NATO because East Ukraine would put a veto on that because they don't want to be part of an anti-Russian country. And it would prevent Ukraine from joining the Collective Security Treaty Organization, Russia's analog to that, or the Eurasian Union, or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It would keep Ukraine neutral. The West no longer accepts a neutral Ukraine. They have been paying lip service to the Minsk Accords for these 7 years while they told Ukraine, don't worry about it, because we are creating new facts on the ground with this military NATOization of the
country. It's similar to how they deal with the Israelis and the Palestinians. They appear to be supporting negotiations while letting Israel continually take more territory.
And continuing the Kiev regime shelling of the people of Donbass in an attempt to either beat them into submission or drive the rest of them into Russia. There was already some 2 million that fled there in 2014 and 15. So Russia saw this, and they saw it as a ticking time bomb. NATOization of the country, increasing military threats to the people of Donbass, and 7 years. So they made this last big diplomatic effort. And knowing that the U.S. only understands the language of force, they created this military buildup it's coercive diplomacy, but obviously nothing else was working. In fact, one of the big things that set it off is the regime in Kiev has refused to implement even the most basic first steps of the Minsk Accords, like sitting down with the political representatives of Donbass and beginning dialogue. They refuse to sit at the same table. They refuse. They say they're just Russian proxies, right? They deny them all agency. The people in Donbass, they're all terrorists, and you know, this dehumanizing rhetoric, and they said, we don't even know who they are. So for the last almost a year, Russia has adopted the same policy with Kiev. Zelensky, he's just the U.S. proxy. There's no reason to talk to him. We can only talk to Biden. We don't even know who Zelensky is. So there was an aborted attempt at multiple Normandy format meetings with France and Germany, which Russia said, no, 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 we haven't even implemented the last one. There's no point for further discussion. Eventually, they agreed to just the meeting with France and Germany, and they say, hey, could you please exert your pressure on your client state there and get them to fulfill the Minsk Accord so that we can have peace in this country again? And France and Germany said, no, we will not push them on it. And Russia, I was like, well, what is the point of diplomacy anymore? This, you know, it's obviously you're closing all diplomatic avenues. They released the transcript from that meeting and really angered France and Germany that they revealed that. So they went through this, you know, big last-ditch diplomatic effort. And they're doing this as a last resort. Because from the Russian national security perspective, seeing this time bomb, everything, the clock ticking there, they knew the costs of intervening would be horrific to the Russian economy, to Russians having to kill Ukrainians, something, you know, at least in the terms of the Eastern Ukrainians, they're not, they don't want to do, right? Neither the troops, the Russian government, you know, they regard themselves as the same people. They don't want to be put in this position, but they see the costs of not doing anything now as higher than the costs of doing something. It was a last resort. And I think everyone knows that Putin doesn't bluff, right? He tried and tried and tried for 2 months, the security guarantees with NATO, that was a maximalist demand, and he probably would have been able to walk back a few of those things, right? Like the demand that the U.S. removes nuclear weapons from Europe. U.S. has hundreds of nuclear weapons in Europe, for people who didn't know that. they probably would have walked back from a few of those points on NATO just to get the Minsk Accords passed, because at least it would de facto, you know, rule Ukrainian admittance formally into NATO out. Without NATO having to say that they closed their doors, without the regime in Kiev saying we gave up on NATO ascension, just allowing the people of East Ukraine to quietly veto the issue. And that all failed, right? There was not a single bit of concession on these main things like the Minsk Accords and no further NATO expansion. So Russia launched the intervention as a last resort. And, you know, it's not going to go well for Russia. It's not going to go well for the Russian people. These sanctions are going to bite hard because the U.S. has corralled every single corporation in their country, from Facebook to Instagram to the world's biggest shipping companies, to DHS, to Disney, to, I mean, everything, right?
FIFA.
Yeah. I mean, Russia's sports are not supposed to be political, of course, but yes, everything. And this is this great decoupling. Russia is now permanently separated from the West. And as Russia is, the same thing will be done in turn to China and Iran. It's already being done to them in steps. And I mean, take a look at the internet. The U.S. and the EU are banning RT and Sputnik, right? Google is getting rid of them. Facebook, everything, YouTube. Russia is going to respond, of course, by getting rid of Western media in Russia, banning Google and Facebook and, you know,
Wikipedia.
YouTube, you know, Wikipedia and all of these. Yeah, Wikipedia, which is an entirely CIA and MIA
exactly.
Operation. We're looking, the golden age of the global internet is over, right? Of a globally connected internet. You'll tell your grandkids about it. we're seeing the, you know, that transition happening right before our eyes. You know, China already has a more isolated internet, but now you're going to see regional internets form. The West will have their internet. The Europeans might want to separate theirs a little bit from the United States at some point. Russia and the, you know, the surrounding countries, Kazakhstan, Belarus, a few others, Armenia maybe, will have their internet. China and its friends in Asia will have their internet. Eventually, the Arab world, with their different cultural values from the United States, women, gays, etc., they're going to want their own internet. It's going to become a fractured, divisive, localized internet. And it's the opening salvos of it, the opening cracks are happening right now. Sorry.
Everything that we're talking about, it's a geopolitical shift, an economic shift. Every factor of our lives is going to be impacted by
right
what
now.
You've described as this break from the unipolar world. I wish that there was a more optimistic way of looking at the future, but I guess being an IR analyst, you're being a realist here, Mark. And so I appreciate you sharing all this with our viewers. And at least as all of these fissures come to be, I hope we can continue having these conversations from Washington, D.C. and Moscow.
In some medium we might work it out, right?
Yeah, we'll always find a way. So thanks so much, Mark. I know you're busy. Where can people follow you?
Yeah, of course, right now I'm still on Twitter and Facebook. If that goes away and they take my blue check away and so on, look for me on Vkontakte, which is a refuge. But if you can still find out a way to listen to Sputnik, I'm on Sputnik radio shows basically every day, one or two of them. And lots of CGTN and other non-US media around the world. I'm a pretty frequent guest on, from Pakistan to India to Brazil to everywhere else. So thanks for having me. I love the Gray Zone. I love you and Max. It is always an honor for me to be invited on, despite, you know, representing, again, my wife is Crimean, my family's East Ukrainian, so I have a very different perspective and a personal interest in what's going on there, but I think it also gives me an insight that you don't hear the opinions of the people of East Ukraine a lot. And,
no, and you've demonstrated, you have a pretty good record when it comes to your analysis, I'll say
I think
that.
I do.
You end up right.
More than I'm wrong, unfortunately, because I would love to be proven along on a lot of things. But until then, and I look forward to the day, Mark Cassandra Sloboda signing off.